come to your seats, since it's time for us to start, if my watch is correct, which it probably isn't. The name of this panel is Rules of the Game, Men, Women, and Intimacy. It's the panel that asks the question, is real friendship possible or desirable between the sexes? I'm going to try and find that out. I would like to introduce the panel members. Those of you who have read your apps, read your programs will know this information, but I will read it nevertheless. On my left or on your right is Pam Bradshaw, who teaches kindergarten and writes poetry and practices serial monogamy in Salt Lake City. On my right and your left is Lynn Davis, who is a fundraiser for Ballet West, a mountain climber, and a life's adventurer, and many other things that there are too many to list, let me tell you that. On my far right is Stephen Michael Rapp, who was out of town, and so we wrote his bio for him, and he can't object because he was supposed to get it to us. He is a filmmaker, a dream worker. He has a thirst for enchantment, and he anticipated the men's movement. I don't know by how far, but by quite a ways. For many men, at least the way I see it, the mystery of women is both intriguing and intimidating. Francois Camoens' book of short stories is entitled Why Men Are Afraid of Women. And there's a lot of fear out there. Our culture's gender stereotype of intimacy is that women share on a deep level with other women and that men share with other men by shooting animals or shooting hoops together. Not much sharing goes on between the sexes, certainly not outside of marriage. In fact, we have come to believe, I believe, that most men would rather not talk and at best are ambivalent about intimacy. Yet there is, or seems to be, a constant prattle of the sexes that goes on. This is the pretense by both men and women that they are such totally different creatures that they really have nothing of importance to communicate to each other except from a standpoint of defending their differences while widening the perceived gulf between them. I propose the radical idea that most women and, yes, most men, have profound intimacy needs, often long buried, whether they're willing to admit them even to themselves or not. The longing for intimacy may be accompanied by a corresponding shaft of fear. We can define intimacy in friendships between men and women as containing warmth, humor, physical comfortability, a willingness and desire to share, to listen and to hear, resonant silences, eye contact, emotion, intelligent thought, debate and disagreement, honesty, aspects of love and respect. In other words, the most dangerous sorts of human feelings imaginable. You should have laughed. Sorry. I gave you room and you didn't. As the bumper sticker says, intelligence is the ultimate aphrodisiac. Mormon men and women may have even a more profound fear of intimate friendships than their neighbors. As the abstract for this panel points out, we all know what happens to married men and women, those not married to each other, that is, who ride to state conference together. If you think about Jesus' friendship with Mary Magdalene, it's a fascinating model for male-female relationships. The New Testament record seems to indicate that in an uncomfortable contrast to the customs of his day, Jesus was found in constant intimate conversation with attached and unattached women, including the woman at the well, the woman taken in adultery, Mary and Martha, etc. There must have been talk. I'm encouraged by what seems to be happening at Sunstone. Men are starting to pop up on panels with women to discuss what are sometimes considered to be women's issues. Witness yesterday's panel on the status of women, Brian Kaparowitz and three women, Lynn Whitesides, Margaret Toscano, Lori Winder. That's really my kind of panel. But this is my kind of panel too, and the way this panel came together is not so much how it was formed, but how it came together is pretty interesting. I knew each of the people on this panel, but they did not know each other. And when we came together for our first meeting with the four of us to discuss what we were going to talk about, the experience was an experience in intimacy, which taught me something, and that is that intimacy isn't always one-on-one. And it's very hard to describe what happened, but it was fairly amazing. And we processed what we're supposed to be talking about here today. And so if this comes off, it'll just be a bonus, because we've had so much fun doing the thing itself that up to now it's been pretty wonderful. In yesterday's panel, Brian Kaparowitz referred to the strictures of our culture, which he said makes even talk on the telephone suspect between married people. Again, not married to each other. And I suppose that would include married people who talk to single people and vice versa. But on that same panel, Lynn Whiteside said that to hear what women are saying, men must come in close and listen. We're going to attempt to do that on this panel today, and I hope you'll come in close and listen, and I hope you'll participate as well. And I'm going to ask each of the panelists to give a few thoughts to begin with, then we're going to hopefully continue a conversation about this subject, soon enough we're going to draw you into that conversation, and I hope that you will be drawn in, and we'll want to converse about it. I'll leave it for Pam, and then we'll travel across the table.
Okay. I was really glad that when Paul said practice the serial monogamy, that there were some chuckles out there. Thank you for that. Let me tell you, I'm really happy to have the chance to explain that too. there are many of us who have been married more than one time. And because I write, I told Paul one time that a big fear of mine is that in the little blurb about the author after the article, that somewhere it's going to appear that Pam Bradshaw practices serial monogamy. So that was my worst fear. Now it's gone, Now we've named that, and I don't have to worry about that anymore. But it's interesting to me, also, that when Paul said dangerous, the most dangerous kinds of emotions, that there wasn't a laugh after that. I think, Paul, that you hit something there, really, that there are emotions that we can feel are dangerous. And it actually ties together, because those things are dangerous. Somehow we really need to define what our relationships are. Because I entered into relationships that I called a marriage, then they take on a certain quality, and the people who know me look at me in a different way. At one point, a friend of mine said, "Gosh, Pam, because as I was getting divorced, I was grieving over this failure, that I was holding this failure." And she said, "Now, wait a minute." She said, "We know people who have been involved in a lot of relationships, and they were very serious, deep relationships, but they didn't get married. She said, now, there's nothing there that we add up the scorecard and say, gosh, you've had 7 serious relationships in your life. You know, like someone would say, gosh, you've been married 7 times. What's wrong with you? You know, so interestingly enough, I think that part of what we're doing here is looking at how we define relationships. And if I have a close friendship with Paul, somebody might get uncomfortable with that and want to define that. Well, are you friends? You know, like, and with us, we've tried to define intimacy. I think you did a pretty good job of it there. But I think there's something really central in the fear that we feel within ourselves that in order to be comfortable relating to another human being, we need to have a definition of what that relationship is. Basically, what's happened with us is that we have found a lot of sharing with each other, a lot of common ground. There's been a lot of eye contact and heart sharing. There's a heart connection between us that I don't think we really expected, but we've been delighted to find. And it's been wonderful to not find that to anybody or justify it or excuse it somehow. And that's the kind of sharing that I would really hope to see more and more of among all of us. Maybe if we did that, we wouldn't have to define each other in terms of I'm a feminist or I'm in the men's movement or I'm Mormon. You know, that we could leave the labels over there for a minute and relate to each other in, could I even say Christ love? And I'm going to leave it at that.
I'm Lynn Davis, and a couple of nights ago, I went home and wrote down everything I thought I knew about men and women, and I left all of those notes at home, and I'm sure it was very subconscious the way I did. And as I told this group when we met this week, I feel as if I am to describe the rules of men and women and intimacy, I may describe the rules of intimacy one way one day, and another way, another day. And the rules always seem to be changing. And that's probably very appropriate. In fact, it is very appropriate. But I think it's very hard to define. And in getting together with this group, we did establish some intimacy. And I think if we had recorded our conversations, we would probably find that people took diverse opinions from maybe what they said in prior conversations. And I think today as you participate in this group, we're hoping to have a very spontaneous workshop here today. And I think that you'll find that as well, that you may stand up and say something and go home and reflect on it and refine what you actually said today. When you're talking the rules of intimacy, there does seem to be, if you're in a marriage, and I've been married for about 5 years. Oh, I'm sorry. It does seem to be that if you're in a marriage, there does seem to be one rule, and that is that you do not have friends of the opposite sex for the impression that it might leave. And I think that is a real shame, because I think as you know and become intimate, and I'm not talking physically intimate, but become intimate with other men, in my case, or other women, you begin to develop yourself and develop your relationship with your respective spouse. About a year after I was married, I had the opportunity to go on a Mount Everest expedition. And my husband, who absolutely hates anything like that, of course, was certainly not interested in going. But I was, and he was very supportive. And the reflections of people when I took this trip were somewhat interesting. People in our ward were certain that the marriage, which was a new marriage, was in trouble. I mean, what is she doing going off for over a month to Nepal and spending, you know, time with a lot of men. And the fact of the matter was, there were three women in my group out of 12 men, and in that group, and it was a very, when you're in a circumstance like that, it becomes very intimate, and your conversation becomes very intimate as well. I suppose that there's certainly a possibility that you will break your trust with your respective spouse, but I think if you're secure enough in your relationship and have that intimacy built up, and certainly my husband was very supportive of this, you're not in jeopardy. I guess throughout this conversation today, the only thing that I can convey to you are my own personal experiences. I don't know that they're anything greater than anything that any of you have been through, but I hope that you'll participate in this as well today.
I'd like to make some corrections on the... now that I'm back in town, I can make some corrections. Actually, one of the most painful experiences I have in life is when somebody asks me what I do. It causes intense, instantaneous introspection, and I feel like I have to come up with something that will both announce my persona, what is my face in the world, but my real desire is to try and convey something at a deeper level. I think, in terms of my persona, I think a correct term would be a failed filmmaker. And the part of me that I would like to be known is probably that because I have gone through and feel been ultimately healed in some ways by the Jungian psychoanalytical techniques of Carl Jung, I come from a world of dreams. And one of the things that we were all able to do in the group is try and announce ourselves in terms of a particular language that we were playing with at the time that we all met. I think one of the most marvelous events for me was to listen to Paul read his poetry. And I got to share some dreams. And I'd like to share a dream to announce myself. This dream is dated August 1st, 1984, and I want to, again, every chance I get, I endorse the public sharing of dreams in any arena that you possibly are able to. I think at the pulpit, I think in our intimate relationships, in our friendships. There is no other vehicle that I know of that provides immediate access to the interior of a human being than his dreams. And so I share this dream with you in an attempt to create some intimacy with you. It was a dark bar. It was all men except for one woman who sat at the bar. I sensed from her at first an instinctual animal sexuality. This gave her great power over the men who were there, and they all desired her. There was a true darkness to her sensuality. She was poor and unkempt. She also seemed afraid of the other men, so she came on to me in a strong way, sensing in me, I believe, a strength and confidence that was superior to the others. I sensed her fear and moved to take her quickly to safety and make love to her. We were followed home by some lowlife who was harassing the woman. I threatened him with force and he left. And while in the doorway of her home, I kissed and fondled her. Inside her home, there was a little girl who watched with curiosity from inside. The woman wanted to cook me dinner, but I was too passionate to stop to eat. She got me to stop long enough to start cooking a meal. While she cooked, I approached her again with strong sexual strength and overcame her will. Her breasts were large, full, and dark. And when I removed her dress, I was horrified to discover she had a large penis. It was not infantile, but was hairless, yet masculine. I reeled back in utter horror. She looked at me longingly, but I said firmly, "No, never." She pleaded with her eyes, and I reiterated, "No, absolutely not." Then I left abruptly. Although I was shocked and confused, I felt deep sorrow for her and her child, knowing that no man would ever be her lover. There's two reasons I want to share that dream, is because I want to first introduce the aspect of the shadow into personal relationships, because as has been mentioned here, I think the word dangerous has been used, and this has been an issue I've brought up in the group often, that is the dangerous nature of intimacy, because intimacy is sexy, and it seems to the idea of a man moving close in intimacy with a woman can be frightening for both people or both individuals, but there's some other things I want to talk about too, and that is probably the most it's a strange twist for me on this, because I know this is about men and women, but I discovered a concept in this process that's been foreign and unique and new to me, and that is called kinship libido. Now, kinship libido is energy for one's own kind. And there is, I feel that one of the great events in my life has been that I have developed a kinship libido with Paul. I think that the history that Paul and I could share would be a little bit, we could share later, in the how we came together. But there was a moment when Paul came over to this small little room I'm living in to share a poem he had just written and was excited about. And I was so grateful that I was able to receive him and to receive that poem, and that there was nothing cluttering that experience up with us. And that we can go into homophobia if we must, but I want to at least introduce in your questions and in your thoughts and in this discussion the issue of danger. The other issue I'd like to address, and I hopefully we will, is a quote by Carl Jung that says, "Where love rules, there is no will to power. And where love is not, power fills the void." I'm interested in my life at this time in exploring a variety of ideals. I'm not interested in singular feminist visions, singular masculinist visions, singular Mormon visions. I'm interested in the collection of ideals, and I think in some ways the issues we're going to talk about all center around monogamy. This curse that I think our culture, that our particular culture is placed upon us, that monogamy is the only legitimate form of intimacy and relationship in this world is sad. And I think we should see it as part of the apostasy, a part of the falling away. But why I want to make some distinctions now is that that we are polygamous in many ways. The only distinctions are is do we consummate it? Because I have many, many female friends, and I would describe the relationships as intimate. The only thing lacking is the sexual consummation that would put it in the realm of, you know, legal sort of polygamy, Mormon polygamy. But just a final word here that I still have a very romantic view. I'm looking for images of reconciliation between men and women. I'm looking for issues that will address my broken heart. I find political answers to be just lipid I often find theological answers limited, but when we first met, this was the first quote I entered into my journal the day after we got together. Someday after we have mastered the winds and the waves and the tides and gravity, we will harness for God the energies of love. Then, for the second time in the history of the world, man will have discovered fire.
Well, danger has been introduced into the panel, and we're living dangerously up here. We'll see what happens. You know, broken hearts are not a joke. My 11-year-old son, and he would kill me if he knew I spoke of this, so you must all take a vow not to speak of this. My 11-year-old son wants to get a tattoo, he told us, because the older girl he was in love with broke his heart, and he wants a tattoo that says a broken heart. He wants visually a broken heart, and he wants the tattoo. And it's interesting. He's long wanted a tattoo, and now he knows what he wants on the tattoo. I think we're all brokenhearted in some way at various points in our lives, and I suppose we're told that we're supposed to have a contrite spirit and a broken heart. And that can include all kinds of broken hearts. And I think part of our broken hearts are that we cannot have the relationships that we want, or a relationship the way we want it, or and we are broken in some way. And how do we put ourselves back together? I had no idea I was going to say this. I don't know where this is taking me. But it's interesting what Steve brought up. When I thought I knew Steve Rapp through a few chance meetings at houses and in one case at a men's and women's retreat, I didn't think I liked Steve Rapp. In fact, we had a couple of rather healthy arguments. And healthy arguments usually happen between people who like each other, but I hadn't realized that yet. But so Steve wrote a letter asking why he was being treated in the way he was, and pretty interesting breakthrough. And I went to breakfast with Steve, and something that's happened to me just in the past two or three years, pretty astonishing thing, is that most of my friends have been women, and I feel very comfortable about that. And I never thought it was possible to have a close, it didn't seem possible for me at least, to have a close and intimate relationship with a man in the same way as many close relationships I've had with women friends. And in the past two or three years, I found it is possible, and I have two or three close friends that are male that partake of the same kind of intimacy, which is pretty interesting for me. It's pretty pretty revealing discovery. And so I know it's possible on all kinds of levels to have that kind of intimate friendship. And the morning that Steve and I went to breakfast, within 10 minutes, I knew, without even, you know, there was something, there was a bond there that was pretty, that was very interesting and strong. He mentioned a poem I read to him. I brought that poem because it's about this group. I've never written poetry until about the last 5 months, and being involved in a writing group stimulated that. Pam is a member of that writing group, and I want to read this to you at the risk of, because it's about this group, and because it maybe says something that I can't say otherwise. And it's kind of, well, I won't try to describe it, I'll just read it. And if it does something for you, I hope it does. The name of the poem is Gone With It. Was it a poem or a dream? Floated in one sleepy Sunday afternoon on the wings of Doc Watson's precious Lord, out of my gourd, or maybe deeper in than I had ever been. My tan Impala nudged the bow of the eternal now. Pam's house, a ship. the street an asphalt sea. On deck, I see that Jerry's in his blueprints, Pam's in shorts, the cardboard babies peeking at the galley's stash, and Allie's freshly laundered mainsail means we'll soon be out of port. Still life on afterdeck, Swedish crystal backlit by the sun, filling now with liquid ruby, coral, tangerine. Pam pours this scene, chips and salsa, berries, purple grapes, small triangles of cheese. Stephen's here, dream book and dreams in hand. Lynn sails in black, dark glasses circled by a golden band. We eat, but bites must fit around the words. The meal is sacramental, transcendental, a psychic picnic from the seventh seal. We're linked together in some cosmic flow, and we go with it. Upriver without a paddle, but close quarters. We've gone inland and hear the shrieks of wild birds, sexual metaphors, remnants of childhood, Indian dreams, a potent mix of images and words. Steve's open face delighted as a child's. Pam's freckles shimmer in the heat. I hear the beat of jungle drums. Lynn fans her legs, her skirt above her knees. If I'm the guide, then where's this voyage going? I picked the crew and signed the manifest, but like the rest, I'm just a guest. No one's at the wheel. Freewheeling makes it real. Well, that was a poem about the first time we got together. And as I said, it was a pretty interesting thing that went on between the members of this panel. Now, I hope we'll have some conversation with each other about what we've been talking about. You can feel free to dive in any time. And what I would ask you to do, if you would like to, is... what I would ask you to do is, if you have a question, a comment, to enter the discussion, would you come up and use one of the microphones? I know it's a pain, but it's much easier that way, and we get a sense of who you are, and the audience does, and that sort of thing. I want to ask the panel this question, and that is, when you find that you are sharing with an intimate friend in one way or another, do you notice any difference between the way you share with members of your own gender and with members of the other gender? And my answer to that is, until recently, would definitely be yes, that I'm able to share more easily with female friends for whatever reason, but that maybe that's breaking down some. Any of you want to take a crack at that?
I've never been really great at making small talk. I don't know how you are, but it's kind of a painful thing to do sometimes, is to be superficial and lead in with, oh, what do you do? You know, it never goes anywhere. And to answer Paul's question, I think it's been... I don't think that I do share in a different way with a man or a woman when we're talking about matters of the heart. But it's not very often. Well, okay, I have to say this in two parts. Up until a few months ago, it was pretty rare for me to encounter someone with whom I could freely share. I probably had two or three really close friends. And, you know, it would be a percentage of two women and one man that I could share, and I would feel safe enough to say anything and know that even if they disagreed with me a lot, that we'd still like each other. Interestingly enough, and I the only way I can explain this is that maybe there's been a change inside of me. It seems that more and more people are willing to share openly with me. And I think this is a wonderful blessing. You know, I think this is a great gift. But we'll even, my husband and I recently had an experience where we were walking around the block, and a neighbor that we didn't know very well at all was reading a book on, he was sitting on top of his truck, and he jumped down off of his truck and shut his book, and within moments began to tell us that it was the anniversary of his child's death, and that, and all of his innermost feelings about that. And we were just amazed that he would open up like that to us, not knowing us that well. It just seems to be that more and more, you know, people are kind of inviting me into their area of safety, maybe. And I really celebrate that. Men and women have done that. So that's a little puzzling to me, but something I like a lot. I'd like to say one more thing. It sounds like we've brought up the subject of broken hearts. And I'd like to propose that we all have broken hearts, and we all love our broken hearts. And we pull them out when we want to. You know, that it almost seems like that's a way that if I bring out my broken heart, then I can share yours with you. And it seems like that's a really universal way to relate to each other. And then when we felt that safe with one another, that our relationship can grow from there. Stephen, you talked about kinship libido. That's really interesting that a woman might not phrase it in those terms, you know. But a woman might just kind of take that for granted, that I can share with Lynn, you know, we just walked around and put our heads together and and that was fun. I felt like she was one of my own kind. But wouldn't it be wonderful if we looked at that term kinship libido in terms of the human being kind, and sharing with our own kind, because you're a human and I am too, and we've experienced the same sort of even grief that we all come to terms with at some point. That's all I wanted to say.
I often say, in all seriousness, if I ever had a Urim and Thummim, the first two questions I would ask would be, first, number one, did Lee Harvey Oswald act alone? And number two, is, what is this man-woman thing? I asked that question, a little aside, I finally got to ask that question to Ram Dass. I think he's changed his name back to Richard Alpert now, but I asked Ram Dass that very question. And he gave me an insight that has been very valuable in my life, and that is that you approach another human being as spirit first, and then gender second. And I always thought that was really kind of an interesting idea, although I admit to confusion because of sexual energies that exist in relationships, but I find that with a female friend, there's less fear of reprisal that will take, you know, you won't be denied in the marital bed if you confess to a friend a shortcoming, a fear, a doubt, an anger, that there is an ease that I won't be made to pay later for sharing that information, that we sometimes will have to pay with our spouses if we sometimes say the things that we really want to. And I think that the access to female friends is access to information, and I think that's what's really desired here, is that the opposite sex holds for you the mystery of the other there, and that women hold this mystery for men, and men hold this mystery for women. And how do we find out these things about these women? Where do we get the information about this other thing, this other entity? it seems like the marriage is always confused, and there is so much different kind of energy that takes place in the marriage. It's hard to get information about that person that we're living with. It's because it's so fraught with children the land war, moving this family forward, that we don't have the opportunity to really find information regarding this other person. And in a friendship, the real desire is the exchange of information about each other rather than the exchange of bodily fluids, and that has more importance for me now than just about anything. Is any information I can get, any access to understanding this other entity out there that's so strange to me, so foreign. It's a gracious time for me that I can be seen and not condemned.
I'd like to kind of disagree here with Steve here. I think that probably the deepest level of intimacy is your one-on-one relationship with your partner, and it's supposed to be that way. It's not always that way, but there is a rule, and as long as we're talking about rules of intimacy, I think, and I'd like to see a show of hands if any of you feel the same way, I think that there's a very strong rule that there are certain things that you never discuss with a male or female friend outside of your intimate relationship. And it's probably, from my perspective, it's probably a rule that's more male-based than female-based. I'm getting stares here. Maybe I'm wrong. But I think that there are... does anyone feel that same way at all? There's a couple hands. Couple. Maybe if I can explain that a little bit. I think that even with my closest female friends, there are some betrayals, I guess, in terms of talking about a partner's weakness or his most intimate feelings that would be a real betrayal to him. And so there's a protection that's created in a rule. And certainly I can see some controversy there. I don't think everyone agrees, but I do think, that's all I have to say.
Would you come up?
I thought
we were
going to
be microphone. Well, I have a feeling that I'm getting really left behind in this conversation, that there's some basic threshold that you all have managed to reach that many of us perhaps have not. It's been my experience, both living in this community and also in California, that it is very difficult, even though I work in a profession largely composed of men, to develop friendships with men that would go beyond an encounter in the hallway talking about a particular case that we've been dealing with and so on. In other words, I meet a lot of interesting men, I meet a lot of interesting women, and the women that I meet, I seem to be able to establish friendships with no difficulty at all. Most of the men that I meet feel very uncomfortable about that, even though in many instances I'm, say, 25 years their senior, so there's no possibility of any... Well, I won't say no possibility, but I'm not interested, and I think it's pretty clear, and I should think that their wives and so on would understand it. In other words, it's a non-threatening relationship. What I perceive, particularly in this community, is that men don't even seem to consider the possibility of having friendships with women, even relatively unintimate friendships with women, let alone the kind of standard of performance that you've been discussing here, and I wonder if perhaps you could deal with some of those issues.
Do we want to deal or do we want to have more?
I would like to address what Stephen said in regards to being able to share. And my thought is, I shared some information with my bishop of my personality, things that I like, maybe things that are weaknesses to me, but I know to hear a bishop to hear those things is like, well, you know, that's a little controversial there. But I was being open and honest with him, and later I felt like I wish I never would have said that to him because I felt like it was in some way being used against me in regards to being, you know, considered for a calling in the church or something. And so I think maybe that was because of a male-female relationship there. And even though being my bishop, we're supposed to be able to talk to them, because of that relationship, I was sorry I even said anything. I did want to mention I met Paul Swenson at a LifeSpring training. And through that training, it was very intense, and we were able to see people as human beings first, soul to soul, and then gender next. Had I not been through that training, I would probably still be hung up on these issues. And it has helped me to be able to freely talk to any person at all because I'm able to just break loose and see people as people, as human beings and children of our Heavenly Father. My husband later on did the same training, and because we get real personal with each other, we're always hugging and kissing each other because we're so jazzed about life. And it was really exciting to me to see other women hug and kiss my husband because they loved him as a person. Now, it was not meaning they're going to go home and go to bed with my husband. It was they appreciated him and were willing to give him that affection, which really meant a lot to me to think someone else thinks my husband's neat too. Not maybe in the same way I do. But later on, our marriage got shaky, and we were threatening a divorce. And had I not been able to have an intimate relationship with another man, I did find another man who I was attracted to. But because of the intimacy we had as friends, I was able to explain to him what was going on in my marriage and shared with him some very, very intimate things that I was disappointed with and whatnot. But this man was able to give me feedback from a man's point of view. These were not things that most people would share one gender to the next about a sex life. But he was able to let me see where my husband was coming through from and to help me understand. And my husband and I are closer than ever before now because of those relationships, because we are not threatened by another person. But I think that comes from having a really good self-esteem and having a good basis in our marriage as well.
Just a credential, I to paraphrase, some of my best friends are women, especially my wife back there. But I have a question. I came here because this says the rules of the game, and I'm wondering if you can help bring me up to date. And I'll set the stage. Some years ago, when I was called to be on the High Council, a new crop of us were oriented by the stake president. And he made it very explicit that we were not to ride in cars with women alone and all that sort of thing. And he gave the example that one of the general authorities had been called in by a member of the First Presidency and cautioned and told, do not pick up that widow lady who works in the church office building on your way to work, because that will begin things happening that we can't control. Now, my present dilemma is that last week they gave me some keys. I'm a family history consultant in the ward, and my directions are to take men and women to the stake center at any time of hour, day or night, any time during the week, and orient them to using the computer. The stake center is often totally deserted. I have the key to get in the outside door. I have the key to get into an 8-by-10-foot room to go into the privacy to teach a woman how to use a computer. I reflect this because some years ago I read in the newspapers that the ultimate terminology was no longer referred to as sexual intercourse, but sexual relations with anyone but your wife. This relations is a broad term. Will you comment on what do I do with my keys? How do I use them?
I'm glad that you said that. You said an interesting word. I think you said control. You know, control is something that we've been talking about a lot. And it kind of ties in with that Jung quote about, how did that go again, Stephen?
Where love is not, power fills the void.
Right. If I didn't know inside of myself where my boundaries were, if I was shaky about that in the least, then I might very well be worried that there was a power outside of myself that would make me behave in a way that I wouldn't choose. Now, I know where my boundaries are, and I know what my relationship is with my husband, and I'm not in the least bit afraid of sharing a ride with someone, except when I enter in the variable about whether they know where their variables are, you know, whether the man I'm sharing the ride with knows that he is in control of his behavior and that there isn't a mysterious power outside of him that makes him do things, you know. Yeah, so if you know how to use those keys, go for it. If you're wondering about whether the woman is wondering about her boundaries, then take a friend with you. You know, who can help her check that out. But do you have anything to say about that?
I don't think so. keys as a metaphor to what we're talking about is a little too tough for me to handle. Well, you know, I put that thing in there about going to the state in the abstract for this panel about writing the state conference as sort of a joke. But I guess it still is a serious matter for many people. And, if you know, somebody who brought this up during Sunstone saying, well, that isn't really a concern anymore. You don't hear that from the pulpit anymore. Well, I guess you do in various ways. And I guess what that says is we're all wondering about just how real we can be with other people and how real they can be with us and what that could mean. And I like what Pam said about having knowing where you are. That's half of the problem, at least. No. Oh, yes, of course. Go ahead.
Well, if I could carry it just this much farther, I think that an organization that would encourage people to take direct instruction and not think for themselves might further the idea that there is a power outside of you that could make you behave in a way that would surprise yourself.
I was. My father failed to initiate me into the world of sexuality, and so I got all my sexual information from my mother in a very strange and somewhat perverse way, but. I can remember to this very day, my mother would say to me, now, you've got to remember that when you get an erection, it is too late. And this was drilled into me all my life. And I believed her. When I got my erection, I felt it was too late. It was okay. But, and I think, you know, we are primed. it's almost that intercourse is the expectation. When a man and a woman get together in an intimate situation, the only outcome that can possibly come from it is intercourse. And if you're married, the outcome can only be pain. And the end of families, and we've all seen it. It's true, and that's the problem, because the reason why we probably get these messages from the church about writing to stay present is because somewhere or another there's a history of pain and great sorrow that the church is relating to. But I really feel that the church almost sets up at times with those kind of rulings and those kind of dictums. It's like saying this will happen, and as if there's no other alternative.
Yeah. Let's see. Something you said I wanted to talk about. Do we have a question? Please.
I find the dialogue between the four of you quite interesting. I'm reminded of a movie called When Harry Met Sally. Have you seen that movie? Have you folks seen the movie? And for those of you who haven't, Harry maintains that a relationship between a man and a woman is not possible because the sex part always gets in the way. And she thinks that that's not true. She thinks that she can have this platonic relationship and it's okay. I would like to have the panel and or anyone else here either confirm that Harry is right or that she is right. And tell us what the rules would be to make either one of them possible.
I'll just answer it real shortly with another movie that I saw. It was called Sexual Obsession. It's one of the most memorable scenes of all time for me in a movie. Art Garfunkel, who is not a very sexy guy, was the star. But Teresa Russell, they're at a party.
Who is a sexy guy?
Yeah. Well, they're at this party, and he looks across the crowded room, and there's Teresa Russell sitting in the doorway with her leg propped up in the door and looking quite good. And he slowly walked across the room, and they came and locked their eyes in an embrace, and she looks at him and she says, "If we don't go any further, it could always be perfect."
Well, yeah, I'm struck by the fact that we're talking all around the fact that the word intercourse, I mean, there are more than one kind of intercourse, but they're both called intercourse, which is a little interesting. Social intercourse, sexual intercourse, means some kind of exchange of something between two parties. Is that so? You know, the very word, I guess, could be pretty scary. Having an exchange of who you are with someone else who they are. That's intercourse. Where do you draw the line between what is most intimate? I don't have any answers to, you know, I can't draw that line in the road for you or for me necessarily. I think we all long to have something deeper than simply the kind of talk we exchange with each other from time to time. And it happens here at some. Go out in the halls and look at people deep in intimate conversation. Some of them are women talking to women. Some of them are men talking to men. Some of them are men talking to women. Scary stuff. But it's real. And somehow you have to find your own line and draw it. But it's the best and the worst, depending on how you handle it, I suppose. Yes, the question was, who was right, Harry or Sally? I want to know, for some people, Sally, I can't tell you a rule that applies to everybody. For some, yeah, we could vote. Who thought Harry was right? And who thought Sally was right? Yeah. Well, you know what happened to Harry and Sally? It was like the people who wrote to State Conference together. But I think everybody has to answer it for themselves, I'm afraid. Come up, please.
I wanted to relate just quickly a little story that happened. Maybe this answers my question already, but I had a very dear cousin named John, whom I grew up with, and he was like a brother, truly, to me. And he moved into our ward from California, and there was no way of announcing to the ward that this was my cousin. But his wife was a nurse and often gone on Sunday morning, and my husband taught a class. So I would go into gospel doctrine class, and I would sit by John and visit with John. And it started to occur to me that people were looking at us very funnily, you know, kind of funny. And so it finally became apparent that I had to explain to people. I found myself turning to people and saying, did you know that John Smith, our names are different, is my cousin? You know, I always felt like I had to explain this, that there was something wrong with sitting in a church meeting and talking to this person who was very close to me. And I don't know if any of you have felt that kind of thing. But when I came to this today, I'll be honest with you, I hoped, like he said, I guess I'm a Sally. And I'd hoped I'd hear today that, yes, it is possible for women to have close relationships with men without sex being involved. But I have to be honest with you, when you first said, your first impression of your meeting, the first thing that came across was the skirt above the knee and the shining freckles and tearing dresses off of women. And maybe I have to conclude that Harry's right. There is no way. I don't know.
Wow. Well, I think recognizing that there is an attraction between men and women is the first possibility of dealing with having a relationship. If you pretend it's not there, then I don't think it's possible to even figure out where you stand on it. But if you know it's there, and if even a friend, if you know that that exists, then you have a chance of dealing with it and working it out. I do think it's possible. But it doesn't mean you don't pretend it isn't there. That's right. That's right.
I feel like in order to actually deal with the issue of the question being asked, you first have to begin with recognizing that the degree of need that's involved in terms of male and female relationships depends upon the degree to which the individual, as Pam has suggested in a way, has a sense of wholeness within themselves. The individual who, in a sense, knows what they feel and is able to own the different aspects of the needs, the anger, the fear, the hurt, the essence of themselves, in a sense, to where they're not ashamed of it or guilty over it or afraid of it, tends to function in life in such ways that they are open, because they're not having to be always on guard with everybody. They can share what they think, because if the other person disagrees, it doesn't destroy them. Their own sense of fragility is not so intense that they be overwhelmed by other people's judgment or their other people's disagreement. And this is difficult, but yet at the same time it springs fundamentally from the capacity of the individual to have a real sense of in touchness with their own legitimacy as an individual. Now with that, there is a involvement in life and in relationships that is open, flowing, free, and satisfying, whether it's male or female. The sad thing is that most men have been too often cut off from that kind of thing. They play the game of being masculine, or they play the game of a role that they've learned, or they play some other kind of game and do not fundamentally feel that sense of wholeness within themselves that allows them to relate to another woman or to a woman or another man in that kind of free-flowing, satisfying way. Because when we talk with someone and we talk with them with a genuine openness of our sense of our own validity and our sense of our own self, then there's a sense of fulfillment in it. If you say to somebody that is genuinely an expression of where you are, there is a sense of why your own okayness in the very expression of it. And it doesn't demand that they respond and say, gee, you're okay. It isn't demanding the world give you validity, because you have that sense that flows from within yourself. Now, in that kind of a relationship, yes, you can go with a woman somewhere or with a man somewhere, because your needs are not so great that you have to consummate it through sexuality. Granted, the sexual drive is there, but it isn't the only basis on which we relate. When we can share and experience emotional intimacy because of the sense of wholeness within ourselves, then we don't have to rely on physical intimacy to make up for all of the emptiness within us.
Amen.
It's been really interesting listening to everybody talk about intimacy. I just spent a year and a half in Seattle working with 3 and 4 year old children who taught me more about intimacy than I'd ever learned before. Watching them interact with each other and seeing how definitely intimate they are with one another. And it has nothing to do with sex, and it has nothing to do with anything like that. And it's very pure. And growing up, now I'm in a stage where for the last 19 years of my life, it's been fine to have friends as guys and girls, and there's nothing, but it changes around this time, and there's more pressure, and there is this big deal about if you're intimate, it does lead to sex. And I think that a lot of the reasons why you say Harry's right is because our society says it's right, and so it happens that way. But it doesn't begin that way, because it's very pure in the beginning. And I think that that's what we need to awaken all of us, is that we are born intimate people. We are born intimate with one another. We're born in societies. We're born into families. And it's what we know. And it's just natural.
Thank you.
Come up, whoever.
When I was first married about 4 years ago, one time when my wife and I just had a real difficult time coming to terms about something, I went to a friend's house of both of ours, and I talked to her for a little bit about this little problem between us. It was nothing really major, but it was there nonetheless. And she told me of a lady in her ward, an older lady, who explained to her the difference between men and women and why men and women tend to clash so much. And she told this to me, and she said what this lady told her was that men think with their brains and women think with their hearts. And when a woman comes to a man, she explained the situation between my wife and I perfectly, not even knowing what it was. When a woman comes to a man with a problem, the man immediately tries to solve it, which I was an expert at. I tried to solve everything. And my wife would always get so angry at me because I would immediately try to offer solutions and not give her a shoulder to lean on for a minute or to sympathize with her. And after my friend told me this, I put it into action a few times, and I noticed an incredible difference. In fact, the first time I did it, my wife was so shocked she didn't really know what to do, because I reacted how she wanted me to, and that was too much. But I've noticed since then that although I don't believe it's right to always think with your heart or to always think with your brain, it's something that men and women kind of need to both work at. They need to remember there's times to be logical and there's times to be sympathetic and caring, and you have to try to balance those out. And as I've tried to do that, I found that it's really helped a lot with us, and I think that if it's something people bear in mind, it could help a lot of problems, especially between married people.
I'd just like to make a quick little comment, too. I know I'm not supposed to talk about this, but I think the loss of the 5 points of fellowship in the temple is tragic. If I was prophet for the day, if I could do nothing else in the church, it would be to restore communal dancing in our wards. As I grew up, the square dance to me became a place where we met. And if anybody has ever, I've had what I would consider to be revelations while I was square dancing. I kid you not, Hugh Nibley pointed this out. The prayer circle in the temple originally was a dance. And it was a place where you danced with not only your spouse, but you danced with the members of the community, and that the coming and the going, the Alaman left, the Alaman right, the do-si-do, with other women, the opportunity to be able to hold another woman in a legitimate container. We've lost all those containers where we can come together legitimately and hold, be held, and hold other people. We've thrown all those containers away. We can't even do it in the temple anymore. I think these losses of containers are continued signs of apostasy. I think we're continually getting what we deserve in some sense because of our failure to preserve these places. Go ahead.
That's a good introduction for an incident I wanted to tell you. I pondered over it for 30 years. This was a psychiatry seminar given by the University of Southern California Department of Psychiatry in Las Vegas. And we had about 100 psychiatrists there. In the morning we had our lectures, in the afternoon our workshops, and we experimented with private space and so forth. And then they had us perform an experiment. Close your eyes. They had us all close our eyes. And they said, now go around touching until you find a pair of hands that feel good. What do you mean, hands that feel good? Well, they kept guiding you around, and after about 4 or 5, I found a pair of hands that felt good. And so then they asked us to, now keep your eyes closed, but express just with your hands friendship and other mild emotions. And finally they got into love and hurt and anger and so forth. And finally they said, open your eyes. I've never been so shocked in all my life. Here was an attractive woman about my own age, and we were standing there emotionally naked. We knew enough about each other to go across the street to the marriage thing and get married right then. I don't think we have the slightest, a very, very small degree about what's going on in all of this, pheromones or whatever it is. But why? Why did hands feel good? You ponder it too.
Why not?
Can't beat that.
I just have a quick question for you. I found that my intimacy needs changed when I became divorced. Obviously they do. You no longer have someone you can be intimate with and share. So I guess my question is, do we need different kinds of relationships? Do singles need different kinds of male and female intimate relationships? Are they different than those that are married?
Well, this is not a direct answer, perhaps. So what this brings up for me is the strange prohibition, unwritten rule, since we're talking about rule, seems to be in Mormon experience that once a person is married, there is no likelihood that that person would be interested in keeping the friends one had when one was single, and single people have single friends, and the married people have married friends, and that there's no sort of the twain do not meet. Doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I don't really understand that unwritten rule, and I've never felt that way. And I think it's time those kinds of models. I think it's time we started questioning and saying we can have friends in all kinds of situations, and then people might not feel when something broke up that they were. It happens with divorced people too, of course. I have friends who've recently divorced, and. You know, there is some expectation you will choose one or the other to be a friend to. You can't possibly be friends to both of the divorced people. Well, I think we ought to question that as well. And I mean, you don't want to be comfortable with a person who is uncomfortable about such a thing. But on the other hand, we ought to look at all of that stuff and say, what does it really mean?
I think when you're single, establishing intimacy without the physical connection is much more difficult. I think that if you're talking with a man and you're expressing your deepest intimate thoughts, there is that expectation, and it goes back to when Harry met Sally. But also, I do think that there's a real need when you're single, and I was a single parent for about 8 years, a real need of physical connection. And it may not be sexual, but you miss touch, and you miss that connection. You miss someone lying next to you in bed and hearing someone breathe through the night. And I think that as a single person, you have to be somewhat creative in how you satisfy those needs.
I have two issues. One is I was a single parent too for a while, and I felt that you become particularly vulnerable when you've been married and then you become single. You become very vulnerable to needing someone just to put their arms around you. And I used to come home and I would say to my two children, okay, it's hug time, because we all need it. We needed it desperately, and that was the first thing that we would do. Second issue I'd like to address is, does anyone have any problem with the issue of intimacy in the workplace? I have a real problem with that because I must be Typhoid Mary. Where I work, I'm the only female on a particularly, well, it's an all-male faculty. And when, for example, we might have lunch where we're all invited, there'll be these big round tables. I will sit at one table by myself because I must be dangerous. And it's really scary because I've been in this same work situation for 5 years. My colleagues have never asked me to lunch. If I ask them to lunch, they've always got something else to do. Is there something scary about me? Could someone here tell me? Do I have a problem?
There's something scary about them, actually.
I would like to ask the panel about just this issue of fear. Maybe you're discussing it, but I'd like to get a sense of why men and women seem to be so fearful. Now, I see a lot of women and men in my work, and it doesn't seem to me that, it seems to be the one common thing is that people are just so frightened of relationships. A Mormon woman recently told me, in terms of her man she was thinking of having a relationship with, she said, well, I could maybe go with him, I could even maybe live with him without being married, but to be married to him, and to be married in the temple, that would be just too, I mean, that would have to take the biggest reorganization of my whole life. I don't know, that's just one thought that comes about this business of fear. It just seems to me that I see that there just seems to be fear at every level. Men seem to be dropping out. Women seem to be frightened too, even though they seem to be more ready for relationships in some way. But I would be interested in the comments.
I'm immediately struck. Recall the Scott Peck statement that marriage is the most dangerous place for love. I think we're so terribly beat up that the idea that somehow or another it used to be back in the 60s when we were all living together and we could do it without the sanctity of the church or sanctity of the state. The idea of getting married sort of, I'm not quite sure what that represented anymore. It was like it was a symbolic thing, but I can't remember, you know, it's like we'd done it all. And now we were going to get married. Well, I'll be darned! You know, the moment you get that, I don't care how long you live together. The moment you get married, that relationship changes fundamentally. Some people agree, some people disagree. I'm still horrified that somebody I was. So in love with, I could be in such conflict with. The degree of conflict and the degree of pain, much like this session we went to with Aaron
Silva,
where he talks about the death of a child. It's that the degree of love is it puts you in a very vulnerable place to where you're also very vulnerable to pain. And it's almost that the more love there is, the more vulnerability there is. And that vulnerability is so frightening because, you know, I think we're all pretty battered. You know, I don't have very many friends who I would describe a marriage as a real healing, healthy place to be right now.
Wait a minute.
I know.
Hold on.
You're still newlywed.
If we counted all the years that my husband and I have been married together, he with his wife, and me with my husband, we've been married 23 years.
I think any time you have a relationship that's deep and open and honest, there is a lot of risk. And I consider myself to be very happily married, and that doesn't mean that my husband and I never disagree. We sometimes violently disagree. And hopefully that's the way we grow together, as we learn from each other and by solving our problems and trying to accommodate to each other. But I had an experience about, 8 or 10 years ago with a friend, a male friend, who I mean, he was really sort of trying to pick me up, and in my naivete, I didn't really even see that, and I had all these preschoolers at home, and nobody had treated me like that since I was in college, and I was so flattered, and so, you know, we got this friendship going, and I'm sure we could have gone to bed, and I would have enjoyed it, and he would have enjoyed it, but I would never have done anything to my marriage relationship, because that was so special to me. But by the same token, I didn't want to just say, no, I can't even talk to this man, I can't see him. And I remember just sobbing because it's too bad that we can't have that relationship with more people. And I guess in polygamy, maybe they could. I'd sure hate to try that. We're still good friends, and he has since divorced his wife and married another woman. And we just have this connection that's wonderful, But it didn't have to be physical. It was a wonderful spiritual connection. And there was pain involved, yes. And there was a pain on the part of my husband because he was wondering what in the world I was doing. And I just kept saying, trust me, I love you. I would never do anything to our marriage. And he said, I know you feel that way, but do you realize what a chance you're taking? And that's it's a terrible chance. And it's a chance we have with our children all the time. When you're open and when you open yourself up to be vulnerable, you may get stepped on. But it's like saying, I'm never going to go out in the sunshine because I might get a sunburn. Sometimes you might. That's the chance. But it's part of being alive, and it's, I think it's really important.
I'm still looking for the rules. And I totally agree with the sentiments that have been expressed that when we reach a stage of maturity and can make all these valued judgments in a proper way, my question will be, what should we teach our teenagers as the rules they should follow? I haven't heard any clear guidance on that. Let me set the stage for a story that I told every group of missionaries that came into the mission field, and I hope it had some impact. Maybe it was good, or maybe it wasn't. We had social gatherings every 2 weeks so that they got together to have this kind of communal relationship that was friendly without other things happening. The story is that the only sex education talk my father ever gave me was one. I had grown up around animals and I knew the facts of life, but when I was a freshman in college, a car full of us were coming to this big, witty, wicked city of Salt Lake City for a football game. We were going to stay overnight. So 20 minutes before we left, my dad took me downstairs to the basement and said, I want to tell you something, Madison. He said, when I was a boy growing up, there was a pattern of going around riding in the sleigh with, you know, hay and singing songs and going to different places, and then we'd end up at a certain place to have the rest of the party. After a party was over, one of the young men went into the bedroom to get his coat, and the young lady of the house slipped in behind him, turned the key in the lock, dropped it down her dress.
You're still doing with key.
Key? Well, so the upshot of it was, the rest of the group was out in the sleigh. He kicked the window out, dove out into the snowbank, and said, hey guys, wait for me. Well, the implication was that if a girl did that to me on the 9th floor of the Hotel Utah, I should go out the same way.
We've got 1 minute left. You want to do a wrap up? No, you do it. Well, I don't know.
My daughter's here. I'd be curious to know what I've taught her about this. I really would.
Great. Terrific. That's how we'll do it. You get two microphones.
One for each. One for each big mouth, probably. Speaking, I guess, as part of being a teenager, sorry. One of the things I'm noticing that I'm struggling with is I think that the basis for male and female intimacy needs to probably start, heaven forbid, at puberty. But one of the things I noticed, especially growing up in the church, is that your intimate boundaries are given to you. You don't develop them yourself, and so when it comes down to that final moment when the world is coming around and it's, oh my God, what is this going on, and the unseen forces, you don't have any personal experience to reflect upon, because when you were, you know, 13 or 14 years old, your boundary, they were on a piece of paper. They were your stake dance get standards, you know, this far away and so on. So I think that I don't know how you would necessarily go about doing that, but right now it's really difficult for me to set my own sexual boundaries, my own intimate boundaries, and so on and so forth, because I wasn't allowed to develop them on myself because of social stigmas, church stigmas, Mormon stigmas, so on and so forth. But I think that the fear comes from the fact that we don't know what they are. We, men and women, don't know what their sexual boundaries are, their intimate boundaries are, because we were never given a chance to develop them on our own. So that's basically where I think most people are. I don't know.
Did I ever teach you anything of any value?
Yeah, in fact, he gave me this really long, I haven't finished reading it, but it's on spirituality and sexuality. I remember we were sitting in our basement, and he was saying, going on the notion that Jesus is a really sexy guy. And if you think about it, if we're all made in his own image, that he must have been a really sexy guy because of the intense sexuality between men and women. So that was really a really shocking thing for me to understand, that Jesus had sexuality. I don't know. It was really shocking because you grow up thinking that you're very asexual until that one moment where you're so sexual you can hardly stand it. So I don't know. Anyway, that's all.
Have you ever come to the end of a movie and you realize you're being set up for the sequel? I think that's what just happened. And there was...